Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, September 3rd, 2025, we're delighted to host our 2025 Ethics CLE on recent developments in legal ethics and professional responsibility. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, we will keep our introductions of our guests today brief, certainly more brief than their careers would deserve. So I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we're fortunate to have with us as our moderator, Judge Jennifer Perkins, who serves on the Arizona Court of Appeals for Division One. And I'll leave it to her to introduce our panel. I have two last notes before I get off your screen. The first is that if you are seeking CLE credit, we will be posting a CLE code in the chat box at some time during this presentation. A slide will also appear on screen to let you know that the information has been posted in the chat box. If you have any questions, please feel free to put those in the chat box as well, and I'm happy to answer them. You'll need to take that code and write it down so that you can submit it as part of our webinar in our reporting form. Also a note, if you have questions throughout the panel, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they will be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Judge Perkins, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you so much, Kayla. And thank you to the Federal Society for hosting this CLE. Thank you for our outstanding speakers who really have quite a bit of information to share with you. And so we're going to be moving quickly through the subjects. And to that end, my introductions will be quite brief as discussed. But I encourage you to explore our speakers' very impressive biographies, which are available online. As Kayla mentioned, our plan is to allow some time for audience questions. We will do that at the very end of the program, not after each speaker. Please do use the Q&A function. We'll be keeping an eye on those, and I'll do my best with those submissions once our speakers conclude their remarks. We're going to kick off today with Jack Park, who currently is with Indigo Energy Partners, and for our purposes, importantly, is the chairman of the Executive Committee for the Federalist Society's Professional Responsibility and Legal Education Practice Group, which is the group sponsoring this webinar. And Jack will walk us through recent developments related to Rule 5.6B of the ABA Model Rules. Once Jack concludes, we will hear from David Cunanan, who currently serves as independent bar counsel here in Arizona and is a retired Superior Court judge. David will explore a recent change in this state as to who may be designated a complainant under our rule regarding state bar disciplinary complaints, and why that change may be something other states might want to consider. That is my editorial comment, not Mr. Cunanan's. And finally, Phil Seckler, senior counsel at the Alliance Defending Freedom, is going to talk briefly, which will be impressive if we can do it briefly, about the expanding use and misuse of artificial intelligence in the legal profession. Certainly a large topic, but we will hit on it briefly. And with that, Jack, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Judge. As Judge mentioned, I'm the chair of the Professional Responsibility and Legal Education Practice Group. And at the Lawyers Convention, I've introduced the practice group. And one of the things that we've consistently tried to do, albeit not perfectly, is to offer ethics CLE for the lawyers in states that require ethics CLE as part of their CLE obligation. And this is the 2025 iteration of that effort. As Judge mentioned, I'm going to talk about Rule 5.6 of the Model Rules of Professional Conduct. It's a rule that is not often encountered, but it has come up in litigation in Georgia that I have been involved in. It came up as part of a mediated settlement of four medical malpractice cases, and the defendants demanded that the plaintiff lawyer refrain from suing them in the future. Nobody looked at the rules, and I'll explain later why the rule is as it is, but the clients agreed to the settlement and the lawyer agreed to the restriction on his future practice. Then he ran into the bar and the bar said, no, you can't do this. So we're now involved in litigation where the other side is trying to disqualify the side that I'm helping them with. Georgia Rule 5.6B, which is identical to the ABA model rule, provides a lawyer shall not participate in offering or making an agreement in which a restriction on the lawyer's right to practice is part of the settlement of a controversy between private parties. That's what happened in the mediated settlement. Comment 2 to the Georgia Rule declares paragraph B, that 5.6B, prohibits the lawyer from agreeing not to represent other persons in connection with settling a claim on behalf of a client. In their legal ethics, lawyer's desk book on professional responsibility, Ron Rotunda and John Zinkowski note that the rule is designed to protect both attorney independence and the public's right to counsel. They explain that if lawyers were forced to or were allowed to force others to agree to restrictive covenants, then these covenants would impose restraints not only on the lawyer's professional autonomy, but also on the new client's freedom to choose a lawyer. So the model rules justify Rule 5.6B based on two rationales, lawyer freedom and client freedom. Stephen Gillers and others have pointed out that when a client comes to see a lawyer, the lawyer need not take on the client as a client, prospective client. And every prospective client is free to seek another lawyer. That's correct as far as it goes, however. The situation controlled by Rule 5.6B is different. Rotunda and Zinkowski observed that this type of constraint is different from a lawyer's unencumbered decision to reject proffered employment because of the manner in which this restraint comes about. It is not the result of the lawyer's voluntary forbearance. Third parties impose this restriction at the time of settlement. And at this point, it's useful to keep in mind, a lawyer shall not participate in offering or making. So one party proposes, both sides make, and it seems to me that it's a two-way street that binds both of them. The inclusion of such a restriction also puts the lawyer for the settling clients in a conflict of interest. Rotunda and Zinkowski again. A lawyer would be in an inherent and inevitable conflict of interest situation whenever his client, the plaintiff, wants to settle and agree to the opposing party's condition that the lawyer not represent any future plaintiffs against this defendant or not represent any future plaintiffs in this kind of lawsuit. The restriction on the plaintiff lawyer's right to practice costs the plaintiff nothing. It is, as the saying goes, no skin off the plaintiff's nose if the plaintiff's lawyer must forego future restrictions on that lawyer's right to practice. But it does limit the lawyer's ability to practice and the ability of future clients to hire that lawyer. So it is against public policy. That reflects the reality that it is the client that decides whether to settle, not the lawyer. And if the client agrees to the proffered settlement, then that wraps up that lawyer's activity on behalf of that client, other than wrapping up the settlement. The rule applies to lawyers on both sides of the transaction. A state bar of California opinion in 1988 makes that clear. And it said that ethics opinions have uniformly held that the defendant's attorney may not directly or indirectly propose such a provision, nor may a plaintiff's lawyer attorney accept it. if that happens, both attorneys have violated Rule 5.6. A New York City formal bar opinion likewise states that New York's parallel to Rule 5.6 is directed to lawyers on both sides of the restrictive agreement. The North Carolina bar declared that North Carolina's parallel to Rule 5.6 prohibits a lawyer from offering a settlement that contains a restriction on a lawyer's right to practice as a condition of the agreement. And Rotunda and Zinkowski say that a lawyer may not ethically agree to the restriction, and the opposing lawyer may not propose or require it. The solution, is to make such an agreement void and unenforceable, not simply unethical. A comment in the restatement third of law governing lawyers makes that clear. Subsection 2 states the prohibition against restrictive agreements made in settling a client's claim. For example, a defendant, as a condition of settlement, may insist that the lawyer representing the plaintiff agree not to take action on behalf of other clients, such as filing similar claims against the defendant. Proposing such an agreement would tend to create conflicts of interest between the lawyer, who would normally be opposed to such a limitation, and the lawyer's present client, who may wish to achieve a favorable settlement at the terms offered. The agreement would also obviously affect the freedom of future clients to choose counsel skilled in a particular area of practice. To prevent such effects, the agreements are void and unenforceable. So that's the 2000 Restatement of Law Governing Lawyers, Section 13, Comment C. I'll make one last point. We might suggest that having agreed to a settlement in which a plaintiff's contingency lawyer gets his contingency, he may be a stop from contesting it. Think about standing. Who is injured? Who can complain about that his proceeding further? It is only the defendant who proposed it and the defendant's client. And if estoppel applied, then the rule would be swallowed. And so really, Rotunda and Zinkowski say estoppel doesn't apply. With that, I will yield my time.
I think that puts me up. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for being with us today, and I appreciate the opportunity to present to you today. I'm here to talk about some changes that Arizona made to its professional conduct rules just a short time ago. Just as some background, Arizona had kind of been a hotbed of a lot of different types of litigation over the elections and various other issues that rose up on a national level but played out at the state level. And what we were seeing is that we had an influx of individuals who were filing complaints against various attorneys in our state, some from out of state, some from in-state. But they were not individuals who were necessarily involved in the litigation. Normally, when we think about bar complaints, those complaints come from people within the litigation itself, or the judge or other someone who is actually directly associated with the litigation. But a lot of these complaints were coming from outside the litigation context in terms of people who either saw a news article or heard something or felt that something was unjust in the way that it was being handled. The issue became who has access to information. And really that was the crux of our rule change. Under Arizona provisions, normally a complainant is allowed to or is required to receive a copy of a respondent's response. And a lot of times that has a lot of sensitive information into it and a lot of information that is not readily available to the public because it's part of the attorney's file. And that has to be disseminated to a complainant absent some type of protective order. So to address that, And really, the bar believed that it was really unfair to provide all that information to someone who was not a party to the litigation itself. So we made an effort to change that rule somewhat in terms of Rule 53 of the Arizona Rules of the Supreme Court, where we limited the access of information once a complaint is filed. And we redefined who is allowed to have that access. If you are still a complainant as defined within Rule 53, subsection A, you still get the same rights as any complainant would, since you were in essence part of that litigation or had an interest in that litigation. But if you are a third party, the state bar becomes the complainant and you are not entitled to any other information which would normally be associated with what a complainant gets under Rule 53. In terms of balancing, it still allows people to make complaints. It still allows them to come bring their complaints forth, because sometimes third-party complaints are valid complaints, but it doesn't allow access to information that they would not normally have. As you can see from the materials, this in Arizona was a very controversial approach, a controversial rule change. Normally, we don't get that kind of traffic on rule changes in Arizona, but this one got a lot of traffic and a lot of comments. And some people vigorously oppose that particular change in the rules. In terms of numbers, we really haven't seen any downturn in terms of transparency, the other things that we would like within proceedings. But it has shifted a focus to the underlying offenses versus the public nature of the dispute, which was a goal that we had. We obviously want to make sure that any bar associate member is adequate, is professional, and is in compliance with the rules. But we also don't want to, for lack of a better way, put on a public spectacle about what is going on in that underlying bar complaint or charge. So we felt that was a very good balancing of the interest that we have, and it protects the parties and the people who are part of it instead of just kind of throwing complaints out there. I will tell you that, just as a general aside, this is not only a problem for bar associations. We've seen there's been a general attack on licensure in general. For example, if an individual has a real estate license, you can make a complaint against that real estate license, and that person goes through that as well. In the judicial forum, we've seen out-of-state people make different types of complaints against judicial officers who really have no underlying interest in that case, except that they read a news article about it. And sometimes they file multiples. So it is something that we are grappling with nationwide, but Arizona has taken steps to what we believe is to balance those interests and to be able to protect the parties that need to be protected and the system that needs to be protected. So that is just a general overview. If anybody has any questions, I'll be happy to try to answer them at the end. And I appreciate you just getting the taking the time to listen to what Arizona has done. If you need to refer to, please do refer to the material, because we have included both all the objections as well as the changes to the rule that we enacted a short time ago. With that, I think we'll probably get on to what everyone's really interested in, which is always AI.
Thank you, Judge. I will be addressing AI and the ethical use of artificial intelligence in the practice of law. Has been a big topic at the ABA and in state bar associations recently. The ABA model rules don't expressly mention AI, and as far as I know, none of the state rules do either. But in July 2024, the ABA issued opinion number 512, which discusses how AI can impact a lawyer's compliance with the professional rules of conduct. And then over the last 2 years, at least 14 state bars and ethics committees have issued opinions on the use of AI. Many other states have published informal guidance on the use of AI. And for the most part, these opinions and the guidances don't have any dispute. They all agree, generally, that the use of AI in the practice of law does pose a number of ethical concerns. Chief among those concerns are competence, candor, confidentiality, and supervision. And so in the next 15 minutes, that's what I'm going to talk about: competence, candor, confidentiality, and supervision with respect to using AI in legal practice. So first, competence. Must a lawyer use AI to be competent? We're probably all familiar with infamous comment 8 from Model Rule 1.1, which says lawyers must keep up with changes in relevant technology to maintain professional competence. But in opinion number 512, the ABA said, we're not yet at the point where lawyers must use AI. The ABA noted it's conceivable that at some point in the future, lawyers will have to use AI to competently complete certain tasks, but we're not there yet. And state bar associations say the same thing. You don't need to use AI. Even so, the ABA suggested that lawyers should at least be aware of the available AI tools so they can make an informed decision about whether to use them. So if you do use AI, what level of technical competence is required? Well, the Texas Ethics Committee answered that question like this. If a lawyer opts to use a generative AI tool, the lawyer must have a reasonable and current understanding of the technology, because only then can the lawyer evaluate the risks of hallucinations or inaccurate answers, the limitations that may be imposed by the model's use of incomplete or inaccurate data, and the potential for exposing confidential client information. As for the risk of inaccurate answers, the DC Legal Ethics Committee had some good advice on that point. It said, one, generative AI tools are not search engines. Lawyers should not assume that they are. They're trained on limited data sets and might not be complete or up to date. Two, they're not even programmed to accurately report the content of information in a data set. Their purpose is to predict content. Three, AI products can hallucinate, which means they make things up that don't exist, like fake case citations. Four, they build on prior interactions. So if they fabricate cases, those fictional cases will become part of their data sets for future users. And five, AI products simply are not a reliable substitute for traditional site checking. Other problems with AI, as noted by a Kentucky ethics opinion, are six, AI may struggle to grasp complex legal concepts, which can produce misinterpretations. Seven, AI models trained on biased data may perpetuate biases in legal decision making. And eight, AI tools lack transparency because they're essentially black boxes. So it's hard to understand how they arrive at their conclusions. So how can a lawyer gain technical competence in AI? Well, in its opinion 512, the ABA offered this advice. You can read about AI tools focused on the legal profession. You can attend CLE programs targeted at AI tools. You can consult others who are proficient with the technology. And remember, this is not a static exercise because there's a fast-paced evolution of technology. So lawyers must remain vigilant. As far as reading, the report issued by the New York Bar's AI Task Force has a great list of resources to read to learn about AI in its Appendix B. And the DC Bar also identified some things lawyers should consider about the specific AI tools they're using. What is in the news about the AI platform being used? Has it been tested for its intended use by disinterested third parties? Have other legal professionals you trust used it? And try this. Ask it to do something you've already done and compare the results. The bottom line is that a lawyer cannot abdicate his or her responsibilities by relying solely on an AI tool to perform tasks that rely on professional judgment. And failure to engage in appropriate verification of AI output violates Rule 1.1, our duty of competence. So that brings us to candor. Can a lawyer violate the duty of candor to the court by relying on AI-generated output without verification? The answer to that question is yes. Rule 3.3 prohibits a lawyer from knowingly making false statements of fact or law to a tribunal. And Rule 8.4c prohibits a lawyer from conduct involving any misrepresentation. And according to the ABA, even unintentional misrepresentations generated by an AI tool are prohibited misrepresentations. Those could include citations to non-existent opinions, inaccurate analysis of authority, and use of misleading arguments. The ABA said, in judicial proceedings, duties to the tribunal require lawyers, before submitting materials to a court, to review AI outputs, including analysis and citation to authority, and to correct errors. And the state ethics opinions on this issue say essentially the same thing. Here's North Carolina. A lawyer's signature on a pleading certifies the lawyer's good faith belief as to factual and legal assertions therein. So when a lawyer adopts an AI tool's product as her own, she remains professionally responsible for use of that product. Here's Alaska. Lawyers using generative AI have an ethical duty to review the generative AI output to ensure it is free from errors. And here's Oregon. The most obvious way in which a lawyer could run afoul of Oregon Rules 3.3 and 4.1 is through the submission of and reliance on unverified and fictitious cases, citations, quotes, or conclusions generated by AI. Of course, there are many recent examples we all heard about where lawyers are sanctioned for submitting AI output to the court without checking it, and the output ends up being false. One of the first cases was Mata versus Avianca, which comes from the Southern District of New York in 2023. There, a lawyer who submitted briefs that contained six fictitious cases was sanctioned by the court with a fine and a duty to notify his client and other judges about the infraction. The lawyer thought that ChatGPT is a search engine with access to a comprehensive law library. It's not. When opposing counsel and the court raised questions about the lawyer's citations, what did he do? He asked ChatGPT whether the cases were made up. ChatGPT told him they were not and could be found on Westlaw. That also was false. The judge was not impressed. A May 24th article in The Guardian cited a database that has identified 106 instances of AI hallucinations and false statements in court documents. Those instances resulted in fines, suspensions from practice, duties to notify clients and others, and additional required CLE. Indeed, Stanford University researchers have found that large language model AI tools hallucinate 75% of the time. Now, two important points about sanctions relating to AI. First, it's not just the lawyers using the AI product who are on the hook. It's every lawyer on the pleading. In February of this year, the named partner of a prominent law firm was sanctioned for the submission of fake AI-generated authorities, even though his only contribution to the brief was the basic idea for the motion. Why was he sanctioned? Because his name was on the pleading, and under Rule 11, that's enough. Second, it's not just legal arguments that get lawyers into trouble. Lawyers have a similar responsibility over their experts and other witnesses. Recently, the state of Minnesota, in defending against a challenge to its deepfake law, submitted the declaration of an expert on the dangers of AI and misinformation. Ironically, that declaration cited two fake academic articles because the state's expert on AI used AI to create the report and didn't verify the output before submitting it. The court excluded the declaration in its entirety and refused the state's request to submit an amended one. And the court then suggested that Rule 11 imposes a duty on lawyers to ask witnesses whether they have used AI in drafting their declarations and what they have done to verify the truth of any AI-generated content. And again, it's not just court sanctions. AI-fabricated citations have caused attorneys to receive professional discipline. So, for example, last year, the Middle District of Florida adopted a grievance committee's findings that a Florida lawyer violated Rule 1.3, diligence, and Rule 3.3, candor, by filing four separate pleadings with 26 illegitimate case citations. The discipline imposed on that lawyer included a one-year suspension from practice and completion of extra CLE and counseling. So turning to confidentiality, does AI pose a risk to the confidentiality of client information? The answer to that is yes. If you input information relating to a representation into an AI tool, it could be disclosed to others in your firm for use in other matters. It could be disclosed to people outside the firm, and it could be retained by the AI tool for an indefinite period of time. As the Texas ethics opinion said, these are self-learning tools, which by their very nature store and incorporate user inputs into existing data sets to improve their operation. The tool's policies usually even say that. For example, ChatGPT's privacy policy makes clear that it stores your input and may use it later to provide services to other customers. Thus, lawyers who input client information on or their own mental impressions about a matter violate their duties of confidence, risk violating their duties of confidentiality. They could disclose information in violation of Rule 1.6, and they could end up waiving the attorney-client privilege. So how should a lawyer handle that risk? Well, first, evaluate the risk that information will be disclosed. It's a fact-driven analysis because each AI tool is different. Some tools do have a zero data retention policy in which they retain neither the inputs nor the outputs of an interaction. Second, a lawyer would be well advised to consult with IT experts in considering the security of an AI tool. And third, lawyers should use reasonable care in selecting AI vendors. As the North Carolina ethics opinion suggested, a lawyer should ask, one, what is the experience, reputation, and stability of the company? Two, what security measures are in place? And three, what will happen to any information if the company goes out of business, changes ownership, or services are terminated? The ABA said, as a baseline, all lawyers should read and understand the terms of service, the privacy policy, and contractual terms of any AI tool they use. And if client information is to be shared with an AI tool, then Rule 1.6 requires that a lawyer get informed consent from the client. That requires the lawyer to explain why the tool is being used, the extent of any risk to the client, the particulars about the kind of client information that will be disclosed, and the ways that others might use that information to the client's disadvantage. But the DC bar said clients typically should not even be asked to consent to wide-ranging disclosures that could waive the attorney-client privilege or make very sensitive information available to third parties. Let's turn to supervision. Rule 5.1, of course, requires those running a law firm to make reasonable efforts so that the firm has reasonable assurance that all lawyers are complying with the rules. Given the scores of problems that we've seen with lawyers improperly using AI in violation of ethical duties, do you think a firm is required to adopt AI policies to address the use of AI by its lawyers and staff? The answer to that also is yes. The New Jersey Bar Task Force on AI issued a report, and it says all law firms should adopt an organizational AI policy. And it attaches as Appendix 2, a sample policy. A California ethics opinion likewise says managerial and supervisory lawyers should establish clear policies regarding the permissible uses of generative AI and otherwise make reasonable efforts to ensure a firm's overall compliance with the rules. The Kentucky Bar said, at a minimum, those policies must make verification of every AI-generated citation mandatory. Kentucky also said, although policies are an important step, they are not the end of the firm's duties. A firm should create a culture of security and privacy, and a firm must train everyone on its policies. So in conclusion, when using AI, please keep those four issues in mind: competence, candor, confidentiality, and supervision. And remember, those are not all of the ethical issues that have been identified when you're using AI. So be sure to check the specific guidance in your jurisdiction regarding the use of AI in legal practice. And that's it on AI.
Great. Thank you to all of our speakers. We've only got a couple of questions in the Q&A function. So I just got to remind the audience that if you have questions generated by any of this, one of the pending questions is about the materials. And I do not have the answer for that, but I'm going to just mention that if Kayla, if you want to take up that question in the Q&A to let folks know where they can get the materials, that would be great. I'm going to take moderator's prerogative and kick off with a couple of questions that I had. Jack, your discussion about the model rule was kind of tied to a particular case out of, it sounded like Georgia primarily. And I guess I'm just wondering if in the course of litigating that case, have you gotten any sense for how common this type of agreement is across different jurisdictions? Is there a sort of a proliferating problem here, or is this a unique case that you're experiencing?
I don't think it's a proliferating problem, Judge. But, you know, these guys have gone at each other for a while, and the defendants don't want to litigate with this plaintiff's lawyer any longer. So they came up with this in the course of a mediation, and Georgia changed its rule to the current rule in 2001. I don't think there's been a lot of litigation involving it. When it comes up, the rule seems to be unambiguous. So we don't have a trial court ruling yet in either of two cases or two and a half cases, but you know, I think that the rules should be applied to both parties and the agreement held void and unenforceable.
Great. Thanks, Jack. David, I think something interesting about the Arizona rule, you know, when folks have discussed changes to address the problem that the Arizona rule highlights in terms of sort of out-of-state, non-parties, folks who are just reading media reports to address the problem of those proliferating complaints, they've talked about changes to standing to bring a complaint, which of course is not what Arizona's rule addressed. As you highlighted, why would you say that Arizona's approach is the better approach? Or do you think maybe there's more work to be done here in actually closing off access to those types of complainants?
Thank you, Judge Perkins. There is a school of thought out there that would like to see a standing requirement for bringing a bar complaint. In other words, you are directly part of that litigation, and it would foreclose third parties from bringing any type of bar charge. I will say that there are many instances where a third party is a valid source of information for a bar to make sure that the bar members are staying in compliance and ethically compliant. I mean, I'll give you an example of that, a trust account case. In Arizona, if you overdraw your trust account, that bank is required to send the bar a notice of overdrawn trust account. And then the bar will investigate why that account was overdrawn. And they are obviously a third party. They're not part of any litigation. They're not on either side. They're not a testifying witness. They're not somebody's grandmother who's involved in the litigation. They are truly a third party. And we still want to get that information because that could affect many clients if there's something financially improper going on within the firm and allow the bar to investigate that. So there are, you know, another example of that is drug and alcohol abuse. A lot of times we get complaints that are not necessarily someone that's a client, but someone's associated with that attorney or that group of attorneys that has issues with drug or alcohol abuse. And without that information, we would not be able to make sure to get help to that individual who might need it very much at that time. Uh-oh, we've got the code. Everybody get the code now, otherwise CLE goes away. I'm going to give you a second to write that down, then I'll continue. All right. So we would not be able to get that information otherwise. So from Arizona's perspective and from my perspective, I think that we still want to be able to get that information, but we also don't want to involve third parties in proceedings where they really have no vested interest in the information other than that complaint. And we were seeing that a lot. And we were seeing instances where things would be disclosed through responses, and all of a sudden it would go out to the public realm. And albeit without that response and viewing that response, it would have never been put into the public purview, because there are no confidentiality rules once that complainant gets that response, where there are, and there are various other protections that are in place otherwise. So from my perspective, I think that Arizona's rule, again, balances those interests to making sure that the bar can step in and investigate something it needs to investigate. But on the other hand, it doesn't provide a free flow of information that a person normally would not be entitled to since they were not involved in the litigation itself. So I'm going to step back for just a second, because I understand that there was some issue with regarding the materials. And I'm going to tell you what Rule 53 was amended to be, just so you have kind of a background. Rule 53, subsection A, states an individual or entity will be a complainant regarding a charge if they have had an attorney-client relationship with the respondent, direct and specific firsthand knowledge of the conduct described in the charge, or became aware of the conduct in their role as a judicial officer. If a charge is submitted by an individual entity that does not meet one of these criteria, the state bar will be the complainant and pursue the matter accordingly. And it goes on to talk about the different types of things. But you can see we really limit access to information if you are not part of that litigation. And we want the focus to be on what happens, not necessarily a free flow of information and open up an attorney's file. Because a lot of times, in order to respond to a charge, the attorney really has to go into detail about who their clients are, what happened, some kind of thoughts and impressions, and a lot of information that obviously is not normally out within the public realm. So we think we've balanced those interests in Arizona. And if I could just have a second, I was going to answer something about on the AI issue as well, because we're seeing a really big spike in complaints regarding AI usage by the attorneys. I think what everybody should keep in mind on that is that AI is a tool. It is not a substitute for an attorney's judgment and input. It is just a tool. And you really need to treat it like that. Because if you don't site check, if you don't independently site check outside of that, we see that's the spike in cases. People are using that and just filing those pleadings. And of course, that judicial officer catches it. And it always generates a complaint right after that. Keep in mind that it is a tool, not a substitute for your judgment as an attorney. You should always check. As soon as you sign, you should always check. The other issue that I kind of just would like to touch on that is that a lot of times also disclosure to your client that the firm or the attorney is going to use AI is also a good idea, because sometimes we also see complaints that on billing issues about how that AI is billed out and how that and who is going to be responsible for the AI costs and what those costs are going to be. So disclosure and putting that into place with your client prior to representation or part of the representation agreement is a good idea, so you don't generate those subsequent complaints. Thank you, Judge Perkins.
Thanks, David. Phil, unsurprisingly, a significant number of the pending questions relate to AI. So I'm just going to draw from there rather than asking my own. But one of the early questions did address something that I think is a broad question, and it's one that I've had. You know, you've given us some cautionary guardrail kind of areas to think about in using AI. And the question asks, you know, based on these concerns and the findings, is it currently unethically risky per se for an attorney to involve generative AI in legal practice?
Yeah, that's a good question, given everything we just talked about and all the cases that you see. But as Judge Cunanan just said, it is a tool, and I think it's a very effective, powerful tool. I don't think it's too risky to use, but you just need to verify the output. But still, think about how much work you can do to get a head start on the research, on the writing, on reviewing documents. As long as you review the output and verify it in a reasonable way, you can save a lot of time with this tool. So I don't think it's risky. I do think it requires understanding the tool that you're using, its limitations, and then using it accordingly.
Thanks. We're going to pop back to Jack's topic for a moment. We have a question that notes that, you know, we've used the language imposed, which is slippery. If a defendant asks as part of settlement negotiation and the lawyer agrees, should we consider that to be, you know, quote unquote, imposed? What are your thoughts, Jack? Sorry, Jack, you're muted.
Yes, I think that keep in mind what the rule starts with. A lawyer shall not participate in offering or making such an agreement. And the dynamics of a settlement favor the client's interests over the lawyer's interest in pursuing future litigation. So I think imposed is kind of the way Rotunda and Zinkowski think about it. And if you want a settlement, then you may have, then the client doesn't care whether you represent somebody against that defendant down the road or may not care, but really has nothing to say about it. So I think the answer is if the defendant asks as part of settlement agreement and the lawyer agrees, that is imposed or otherwise in violation of the rule because somebody offered and both parties made an agreement.
Great. Thank you, Jack. David, we've had a question. Are there any practical mechanisms to insulate political or partisan court officers, attorneys general? I know there's been a significant increase in complaints against DOJ line attorneys. I was the subject of one of these complaints in an election case, so judges as well. What are some practical mechanisms to insulate these sort of folks from politically driven bar complaints? How do we prevent such complaints from hamstringing elected officials' jobs?
In terms of practical mechanisms in Arizona, I don't think there's a practical mechanism that says you can't file a bar complaint. We have always allowed anybody who wants to file a bar complaint to do that. What I think our rule does is it takes the complainant out of the equation and it just allows the bar to look at the charge itself. And that is important because instead of becoming a complainant-driven issue, it becomes a bar-driven issue. And we are just able to focus more in on the conduct and what happened versus the political nature of the background and whether you are on one side of the aisle or the other side of the aisle. Because from a bar perspective, that should not be part of the equation. It should really be based on conduct and what you did, not who you are or what you're aspiring or what you're touting at that particular time. And sometimes that's a hard distinction for a lot of people to make. I wouldn't disagree that sometimes based upon the bar itself, it could have different connotations and different implications. But we, as someone who looks at these charges, should always be driven by the facts, not by political implications of what we do or how we do it. So that was a very long way of saying, I don't think there's anything practical, but a lot of that rests with the discretion of the bar people themselves and being able to say, I'm going to look at the facts and not get worked up about the political nature of that. Because in Arizona, we had a lot of that political nature coming through. It was up to the bar to kind of sort through that and be able to only talk about if there's illegible conduct, not the politics behind that kind of drove a lot of those independent complaints.
Thanks, David. Phil, coming back to you, this is an interesting question. Do you think that courts and or state bars will eventually treat minor hallucinations as forgivable site-checking errors? It seems that there needs to be some allowance for AI error if there is going to be widespread adoption of generative AI by attorneys. And I'll just say this is particularly interesting to me because I recently had a case in which an entire section of an attorney's brief made an argument that I just knew to be legally wrong. And literally every citation in the section was either fake or incorrect statement about what was in that section. So I'm not feeling particularly forgivable about something like that. It was a lot of extra legwork for us to run that down. But there is an interesting point here about the widespread adoption of generative AI by attorneys. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think actually it could be the other way. I think courts and bar associations might look at the failure to verify AI output as unforgivable. And I know some courts are issuing orders. So the Northern District of Texas is one where they have their own order on the use of AI and what you have to do. You have to disclose that you're using it. And there are some other requirements as well. So definitely, if you're practicing, make sure you're aware whether or not the court you're before or the judge you're before has any special rules or orders governing the use of AI. But I do think as AI becomes more and more of a thing, it's going to be incumbent upon anyone relying on it to verify each source. So I think it's different from like a typo or some other forgivable error. If you literally have a case that's cited that doesn't exist, I think one strike's going to be enough. And Judge Perkins, you're on mute.
Thank you. Right. So I think arguably a follow-up to that, assuming AI can be ethically used and that we're going to have to operate within these bounds, and there's going to be this sort of strict nature of the use, it's I think Jeff Ventrella points out this is going to be a part of our billing in the future. What does that look like? So how do you bill for the purported time saving? Can you incorporate a value bill scenario? And you know, to the point that I think Judge Kananan had raised, what are your thoughts on disclosure at the outset of the representation as to AI use for purposes of billing?
So I'll address the billing question first, Judge Perkins, because it's a good one. At the beginning, I noted that for the most part, the state opinions agree, but I think on billing is one area where there is an agreement. In fact, Virginia, the Supreme Court now has before it a proposed rule on AI that would allow lawyers to benefit from the time savings and not forget about it. Like if they decide to invest in AI, they can recapture some of the value and cost of that investment. Other jurisdictions are not as flexible, and they really suggest that lawyers should not, if they have time saving, that should entirely be written off essentially. Now, as Judge Kunanen mentioned, there might be occasions where you actually bill a client for particular AI tools, similar to some firms billing for Westlaw usage. But apart from that, if you literally are now doing something in 10 minutes, which used to take 10 hours, most jurisdictions have addressed that saying, look, you can only bill for 10 minutes. And I think the Virginia approach is a little more flexible. So the bottom line is on billing, definitely pays to find the guidance in your jurisdiction, whether it's an opinion or just some advisory material to see what the state thinks about billing issues.
So following a little bit on the disclosure element of that, you know, as you noted, Phil, there are some places that have local rules on point. Occasionally it's for a particular judge, if not the entire court, requiring disclosure and certification for use of AI. Have you seen much in the way of guidance or directives in the absence of such mandating rules for what type of disclosure is required or should be done, I guess?
So what I've seen in the state advisory opinions and other guidance is really a discussion of disclosure to the client. As Judge Kunanen said, you know, we do have a duty to keep your client informed. And part of that is to let your client know if you're using AI, especially if it could be material to the representation in terms of decisions being made and actions being taken. I haven't seen much written up in terms of disclosure to a court if the court doesn't have rules. And I'd be interested to hear what Judge Kunanen thinks about this, but I don't know that you'd have any kind of ethical responsibility to disclose use of AI in the absence of a rule saying you do. And just one quick thought, you know, Westlaw's natural language searching, which has been around for a long time, is a form of AI that we've all been using for quite a while. So I don't know. It seems to me that the more sophisticated AI we have now is just an extension of that. And I don't think it would have to be disclosed unless the court said, we want to know.
So there are particular judges in particular jurisdictions that have very specific rules. For my years on the bench, I didn't care how you produced it, just that it was accurate and it was true, because that's what you were signing to when you signed it, right? And whether your associate did it or whether you did it or whether your paralegal helped you with it, however it worked out, you were the one signing and you were the one responsible. And so as long as it complied with that, that's all that I really required to be disclosed. But there are other judges who take a different view of that, and other jurisdictions that take a different view of that. It, you know, part of the billing issues that we see, and we had a couple of cases like this where they were, you know, you're right, kind of value billing. And what they were doing was they were billing at the partner's hourly rate for AI work. And it came through on what we call as a China doll affidavit, which means that's something that we submit to the court, or submitted to the court in terms of attorney's fees award against another party. And so immediately the other side was investigating that and countering that with, you know, why am I paying for this when it was AI generated or AI produced? It did take a little more digging to get to that. And that's when an inquiry had to happen that normally would not have to happen in front of the court. So you should be careful in the way that you bill, how you do, and what your disclosures are. But in terms of the ethical obligations, I think at this point, based upon the rules, you don't have to disclose that to the court. You have a little bit of different duty to your client as to how you do and how you bill. But I haven't seen any courts that are requiring that to be disclosed absent a specific order that they do in their scheduling order or in their standing orders of the court, depending upon the division that you're in front of.
So Charles Wilson asks, will a court support sanctions and compensation to the other side for time spent checking the opponent's bad AI generated documents? So interesting question, you know, Phil or David, if you want to have thoughts. I will tell you, if I have to spend a bunch of time running down false sites, or to be more clear, if my law clerks have to do that, I am probably going to be at least favorably inclined toward that sort of fee request. But Phil, have you seen anything along those lines, or do you have any thoughts on that from the research you've done?
That's good to know, Judge. So I do, what I've seen in the opinions on the issue of monetary sanctions is typically judges looking at the market, meaning what have other courts imposed for fake citations, maybe even per citation. But there does seem to be some desire, whether it's $10,000, somewhere around there per fake citation. But I've seen judges express some concern that they want to be consistent. And I haven't really seen it so far based on the amount of time that the opposing party took to identify and correct it. But maybe in Arizona, that would work.
So I think that it depends upon the type of proceeding you're talking about. I have seen individual sanctions that relate to a particular motion, and in being able to address having to respond to that motion that had hallucinations in it or fake citations, versus an overall award of attorney's fees. And I think those are two kind of different things. And I've seen it more on the individual basis. And I've seen judges that have awarded that based upon having to, what in essence turned out to be a frivolous motion or a frivolous basis. So I think they could be inclined to do that on an individualized motion-based practice, but maybe it may be a little different story in terms of an overall case approach.
Great. Well, we are bumping up the top of the next hour. And so I will just say thank you to all the speakers and ask Kayla if there is any closing information you'd like to provide to our attendees.
Well, thank you so much. I'd like to start with thanks to our panel. We really appreciate you all joining us and sharing your expertise and insight on these topics. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. There is a last CLE comment. For those seeking CLE attendance, the attendance reporting form has just been dropped in the chat. Please open that and complete it following this webinar. A COA with your calculated CLE credit will be emailed to the email address you provide within a week, along with any pertinent CLE credit reporting information that you need for your state. If you do not receive the follow-up or have issues opening the link, please reach out to us at CLE@fedsoc.org and we will get in touch with you. We also welcome listener feedback on our general programming at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And with that, we can wrap up. Thank you all again. We really appreciate you joining us today. This program is adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.